From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Neil deGrasse Tyson got a telescope for his 12th birthday and says the universe called to him. He's been decoding the stars ever since. Now he's the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. He has 7.3 million Twitter followers and a National Geographic show, this hour On Point. Every man's astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, on the mysteries of the universe. You can join us on air or online. What do you see when you look up at the night sky? What has Neil deGrasse Tyson taught you about your place in the universe? How the world really turns? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from New York City is Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He's also the host of Star Talk, a radio show turned podcast and Emmy-nominated late-night talk show on the National Geographic Channel. His latest book out today is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Neil, so great to have you. Welcome.
Thanks, Jane, for having me on. Thank you.
So at the beginning of your book, you write that this is a small volume, quote, for all those who are too busy to read fat books, yet nonetheless seek a conduit to the cosmos.
Yeah.
A lot of big ideas in a little book. What inspired this?
Well, so just to be clear, it's this is not some curriculum that you would find in a university and somehow, you know, trimmed. It's a curated set of mind-blowing things about the universe that are handpicked because I know they're kind of fun and interesting. And you're in a hurry. You don't have much time. And so someone asked me, well, did you name it that because Astrophysics for Dummies was taken? I'm like, no. This is real astrophysics. And it's for people, I think many of us have seen headlines go across the news wires, right? Mm-hmm. Exoplanet. There are these words that might stick out. Exoplanet, dark matter, dark energy, multiverse. And what I've tried to do in this book is create a coherent whole of all of these bits and pieces that have made headlines so that you can come out and be conversant the next morning at the water cooler in your office.
And, all right, and I want to be. Give us one mind-blowing bit from the book that you think we should know.
Well, so they're scattered throughout the book by chapter.
Yeah.
But let me just go straight to the end. There's a dozen chapters, and I try to tie a bow on them all with a chapter titled A Cosmic Perspective. And so so one of them is, by the way, you can get a cosmic perspective from other branches of science. It doesn't have to be astrophysics. For example, biology. So here's one that, by the way, a cosmic perspective is a point of view where you realize how small you actually are in spite of how big you thought you were, all right, or how important or whatever.
Exactly,
So one of them, so it's a reality check on our place in the universe. And by the way, there's an upside to that we can get to later. But
okay.
So there are more microbes in one linear centimeter of your lower colon than there are humans who have ever been born.
Wow.
And so we're thinking that we're some at the top of some evolutionary ladder or humans or we're in charge. But to those microbes, you're simply a darkened anaerobic vessel of fecal matter. And if you upset them, they will let you know it.
Yes, right? Know it.
Yeah, so they will tell you who's actually in charge. And so that's an example of, you know, before you get too big-headed about who you think you are in nature, on Earth, and in this universe, just do a scientific reality check on these kinds of things. And this book contains many examples of that.
Just in the last 2 minutes, I get why you have 7.3 million Twitter followers.
Oh, I still don't. I don't understand it. I wake up, what? You know, should I remind these people that I'm actually an astrophysicist? There's still time to back out. And I don't, you know, I'm shocked every day. I'm delighted, but shocked.
But you do emphasize that astrophysics need not be inaccessible. You say it belongs to everyone. I just want to know how it is that you're able to make these complicated subjects easy to understand for the average person who may not even be interested in astrophysics.
I would claim they were never complicated in the first place. What happened? Yes, there are some complicated things that I will never tell you because they're too complicated. So that's why I say it's a curated set of knowledge that we have gleaned about the universe that is conveyable in this medium. And I've written other books that go much deeper. And, mm-hmm. and when you are no longer in a hurry, you can turn to those. Okay. And ideally, you'd read this book and then you say, wow, this triggers even more hunger, a hankering hunger that I have for the universe. And so now I will get a bigger book or watch a longer documentary and make the rest of my life orbit that, you see, instead of squeezing it into the interstitial times as you might do with this current book.
Do you think there's an increase in public appetite for science in this moment?
Let me give a slightly cop-out answer. I think the appetite has always been there, but producers and directors and others in charge of media have discovered it. Mm. And I don't think they created it. I think they've discovered something that was always there, and maybe people didn't even know it was there. You know what it is? I think as kids, we are all curious. We all turn over rocks and poke things and put our lives in jeopardy just to be curious about our environment. And I joked about this. The parents spend the first couple of years teaching you to walk and talk and the rest of your life telling you to shut up and mm-hmm. sit down. Mm-hmm. And in the shut up and sit down part is a squashing of a native curiosity that we all have. So now I claim that as adults, that ember might still be deep in there.
No.
And all you have to do is fan it and then reignite it. If you can reignite it in adulthood, it could be transformative to a person's life and reintroduce a life of curiosity. Something we've long forgotten from our childhood. And if you are curious and there are things out there to feed that curiosity, it's like a rebirth of mind. And so, no, I don't think people are becoming more interested. I think the interest is always there and it's now getting revealed. And it's not just me. This landscape is huge. Mm-hmm. I have 7 million Twitter followers, but the Facebook page IFLS, I freaking love science, has 30 million followers, okay?
Oh,
it's not just me. The number one show on television is called The Big Bang Theory. Yes, they be caricatures, mm-hmm. but who would have thought 30 years ago if you went up to producers and said, I have an idea for a show. Let's mm-hmm. let's follow the lives of PhD scientists. It'll be hilarious. You'd be laughed out of the room. They'd be looking for the next cop drama or the next medical drama, whatever it is they thought would be the only way you could sell television. That's the number one show. The Martian, the movie, had marquee actors. Each one of them stars in their own movie, came together for this with a marquee director, Ridley Scott, with a marquee budget
and
a marquee release.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a hit.
Yeah.
And so no, it's not just me. There is an appetite being served, and I think it's long overdue.
So I'm curious, in your years exploring the universe, what has surprised you the most?
You know, when you study the universe, being surprised is a native state. It's a natural, oh, black holes. Who ordered that? Okay, well, we got black holes. Oh, the universe is accelerating. Where did that come from? Oh, okay, well, we got that. There are thousands of exoplanets. Where did they come from? Mm. Okay, we got that. Oh, we have Jupiter's, planets the size of Jupiter, orbiting as close to their host star as Mercury is to our host star. Who thought that up? And so we're stumped and surprised almost daily, if not weekly or monthly. So you ask me what surprises me the most? Nothing. It all surprises me.
Mm. So, gosh, I love that line. Being surprised is a native state. What keeps you up at night then? What unanswered questions about the universe sort of fill your mind?
You want to get there this early?
Yes, I do. I want to go right to it.
Don't we have an hour? You are
There's
so
more
impatient.
To come, Neil deGrasse Tyson. There is.
You are so impatient here. All right, I'll tell you, several things keep me up at night. But and there are more. You can ask me that question again later. But I'll give you one right now.
Okay.
One of them is the possibility that we are not even smart enough to know what questions to ask. Mm-hmm. And even if we did, we might not be smart enough to answer them. Because we are not some measure of intelligence in the universe. Who decided we are intelligent? We did. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if there's some other species out there that's also intelligent, would they judge us in that way? We have 1% DNA separating us from chimpanzees who can stack boxes and reach a banana, and we call that an intelligent chimpanzee. Well, suppose building a Hubble telescope and having art and philosophy. Suppose that's not really that impressive to a more intelligent species out there we have yet to discover. They look at us the way we look at chimps. Would they call us intelligent? Possibly not. And they would have thoughts. They would have questions we could not even ponder. So I lay awake at night wondering whether the limitations of human physiology prevent us from even knowing how the universe really works.
How old were you when you became interested in science, in the universe?
I think all kids are scientists, so it's not a science thing. It's the universe in particular. I was 9 in a first visit to my local planetarium, the Hayden Planetarium here in New York. Boston also has a Hayden Planetarium, came later, but it's the same family money from the Hayden Foundation, Charles Hayden.
And you got your first telescope at 12?
At age 12, and that was a birthday gift. And that's when I first saw Saturn through a telescope, which is mind-blowing. And when people ask me, why is Saturn your favorite planet? That tells me that they have never seen it through a telescope, although they just simply wouldn't be asking me that question because they would agree. It's like objectively true that this is one of the most mind-blowing things to see through a telescope, even a simple backyard telescope. And also you put it on the moon. You say, well, I've seen pictures of the moon, so what? You put a telescope on the moon and the mountains and valleys and craters and hills and shadows, it comes alive and it's real. It's got texture. You can almost touch it. And so this can set you that set me off, and I've been communing with the cosmos ever since.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour with Neil deGrasse Tyson about space, NASA, and missions to Mars. His new book is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. You can join the conversation. Are we entering a new space age? Is that a good thing? Are you ready to see humans on Mars? Would you go? Here is Neil deGrasse Tyson's sister, Lynn, explaining her brother's appeal on this week's CBS Sunday Morning.
What he's able to do is to demystify science, and that is the ultimate equalizer. I think any person, when they realize that they can learn something, they don't see even what that mode of communication is. They just know that they've been inspired and that they've learned something. And so I think that cuts through what the presenter looks like. It cuts through race, it cuts through age, it cuts through gender.
Sure does. Here's Esaya Edgehill, a student who participated in New York City's March for Science just last month, telling NY1 why he marched.
Science is really important in all lives of America because it helps us learn more about the world, and also it helps us cure others.
A little Neil deGrasse Tyson there. What a kid. You hear kids a lot in our society, Neil, falling behind in math and science as compared to the rest of the world. I'm curious what your answer to that very difficult problem is.
Yeah, I think first, I was not as mature as that kid was. He sounded pretty young.
Yeah, exactly.
the part of the consequence of when you lag behind the world, I mean, there are many layers you can cut at this. But the first one is, if you lag behind the world, okay, so what? You lag behind the world. Except that then the world leads the future. They innovate and they invent innovations. In science and technology will be the engines of the 21st century growth economies. There's no question about this. If you lag the world, they innovate, and then we have to trail behind that. And that's not a posture that I grew up in as an American, and I bet it's not the posture that Congress wants to take as we go deeper into this century. So the sooner people realize this, the more we can try to take corrective action in the school system, in how science is treated or the attitude people have towards science, as though they can just cherry pick it for what they want, without realizing that emergent objective scientific truths are true whether or not you believe in them. And if you're going to have legislation, it really should be based on objective truths, not what you might call personal truths that come from your religion or your politics or your own personal philosophies. So yeah, the United States has some mending to do in this regard.
Talk more about this attitude towards science. I'm thinking about one of the videos that you put out recently, went viral. You talked about how the inability to agree on scientific truth can dismantle our democracy. Science deniers, you say, now create a recipe for the complete dismantling of our informed democracy. Do you believe there is an anti-science sentiment in the United States right now?
Among some, yes. But I don't think it's anti-science in general. Those same people who might be in denial of certain scientific truths still use a smartphone, you know, and, you know, to find grandma's house on a GPS grid. Many of them are alive and didn't die in childbirth because of advances in medicine. So I think fundamentally people cannot rationally say they're anti-science. What I think they object to is that as adults, they have adopted a certain outlook on the world and think that denying science that conflicts with that outlook is actually overturning the truth of that science. It'd be like last week you gained weight and this week you want to repeal the law of gravity. No, it does not work that way. I'm sorry. So this is and it's too easy to just beat adults over the head when this is a point of misunderstanding. But in fact, as an educator, I look back to K-12 and I notice, I think what happens there is we think of kids as vessels, empty vessels. And you unzip their head in kindergarten and you start pouring information in for 12 years. And then you zip it back up, slap a diploma on them and say, you are now educated. Or you even continue this into college. The fact that today we have college-educated adults saying they choose not to believe in objective scientific truth means there's something missing in that educational background. And that educational background parrots back what they're told, rather than training you how to think, how to analyze, how to process information. That's what's missing, including an entire course just on what science is and how and why it works. If you fix that in the school system, you can't possibly have adults standing in denial of science. And nor would you elect anyone with that posture. So that's why I don't beat politicians on the head. I look back at the electorate, my fellow Americans.
Let me play this interview for you and get your perspective on the other side. This is Fox News Sunday last month. Host Chris Wallace grilling EPA Director Scott Pruitt over Pruitt's claim that carbon dioxide was not a primary contributor to global warming. After showing Pruitt scientific reports that contradicted Pruitt's view, Wallace and Pruitt had this exchange. Here it is.
What if you're wrong? Let me say to you, CO2 contributes to greenhouse gas. It has a greenhouse gas effect and global warming, as methane does, and other types of gases. The issue is how much we contribute to it from a human activity perspective.
Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Oh, yeah. Was that a question?
Yes.
You want me to react?
I do.
So Abraham Lincoln in 1863, when clearly he had other priorities in front of him, in that year, he signed into law the creation of the National Academy of Sciences, because he knew, when you look at Europe and what role science was playing in building the industrial, becoming the foundation of the Industrial Revolution that created such economic prosperity in Europe over the time that this was a celebrated activity of all the nations. He said, we need some of that here in America. So the National Academy of Science was established to advise Congress and the president of all ways that the emergent scientific truths can influence sage policy, okay? By the way, Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, the first of such. And so the National Academy of Sciences have been going strong ever since. And this is the most respected scientist who prepare reports in the service of policy. And these reports analyze all the research that has been conducted and come forth with scientific consensus. Not a consensus of opinion, a consensus of observations and experiment. And one of them is that humans are warming the Earth. Now, and there's a whole report about this and the consequences and how great it's happening and what we need to do. There's an entire report. So if you now work for the government and going to deny what the National Academy of Sciences tells you, then go back to Abraham Lincoln and say, Abe, you didn't know what the hell you were talking about, and I do. Go back, go tell him that. Go ahead. And ask yourself, Why are you in any position of power in this country if the health, wealth, and security of this country is a priority? Because without any understanding of how science works, you are jeopardizing our health, our wealth, and our security.
Let's get Brenda in here from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Dr. Tyson.
Yes, hello.
I'm calling in praise of your humility, not only on your own behalf, but for all of us humans. All my life I have believed, and always will, that if we could be more humble, if we could accept the place that we actually occupy on planet Earth and in the universe, we would grow exponentially in our knowledge and understanding and in what we're able to accomplish. If we could give up the arrogance that we rule the universe, then I believe that we could explore it much faster and more effectively. But the way we behave toward each other and toward other species and the way we abuse other species and our planet home, I believe that if we are able to colonize other planets, we will behave the same way there, unless we learn what Dr. Tyson is trying to tell us.
Brenda, thank you. Thank you very much. What would you say?
Yes, Brenda's captured. Thank you, Brenda. That she has summarized what the cosmic perspective actually is. Consider that your ego often drives from the belief that you are different from everyone else in a way that makes you better. And what the cosmic perspective does, it says, first, you are not better than anyone else. And in fact, you're largely the same as everyone else. But what I want to do is turn the table on that and say, in the universe, where we discover that our atoms of our body come from stars, we're not made of special ingredients. In fact, we are made of the most common ingredients in the universe: hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen. And so you can look in the universe and say, I'm special not because I'm different, but because I'm the same. And it's that sameness that makes you a participant in the great unfolding of cosmic events. And so to learn that, no, you are not different from other humans. You're the same genetically. And we have genetics in common with an oak tree, with an octopus, with a dog. This sameness changes you as you recognize that, no, we are part of an ecosystem. We are a planet part of a solar system. We are orbit a star that's part of a galaxy. Yes, this can transform civilization and how we end all wars. There will never be wars with astrophysicists leading each other into battle. That will never happen.
Brenda, thank you very much for the call. You've had some unusual perspective.
We haven't had a mind-blowing fact in a few minutes. Can
we, do you want one?
Toss one in?
Okay,
yeah, let's toss
ahead.
One in. You ready?
Go ahead.
Okay.
All right.
There are more molecules of water in a glass of water than there are cups of water in all the world's oceans.
Okay, say that again. Say it again.
Okay. There are more molecules of water in a cup of water than there are cups of water in all the world's oceans. What this means is there's enough molecules in one cup to scatter to all other cups that you could dig out of the ocean, which means if you drink that cup and those molecules come back out of your body through sweat, through pee, through whatever, then your liquid effluences are now shared with the entire Earth. And what that means is every glass of water you do drink contains molecules of water that pass through the kidneys of Abe Lincoln, of Genghis Khan, of Joan of Arc, of Jesus. So we are connected through the very molecules of water that we consume. That's a cosmic perspective.
That is a mind-blowing cosmic perspective.
Well, that's I advertised it
without
that way.
Without saying. Neil deGrasse Tyson is my guest. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Do you think we'll ever make contact or encounter other life forms?
Yeah. I mean, life on Earth got underway almost as quickly as it possibly could have. And as I've already detailed, we're made of the most common ingredients in the universe. So that should tell you that there's no reason to think that what happened on Earth is separate and distinct and special and uncommon in the universe at large. Our catalogs of exoplanets, planets orbiting other stars, has now risen through 3,000. And a subset of those are planets that orbit the temperate Goldilocks zone, where the water can be kept in liquid phase. And we know liquid water is pretty important for life as we know it. Yep. So, I don't see anything in the way. Well, possibly in my lifetime, we'll find microbial life, if not in our backyard, the solar system, but on some exoplanets nearby enough to get good measurements. And I wouldn't know if in my lifetime, but I'd like to think that one day we do contact what we would call intelligent life in the universe. Our biggest hope should be that they think of us as intelligent as well.
Right, because you say in the book they wouldn't see us as intelligent life.
Not necessarily, no.
Yeah.
No.
What do you mean by that? How so?
Oh, well, it's just if you just compare. So getting back to the chimp-human comparison, there's about 1% difference in DNA between the two of us.
Yeah.
And we do great things that we say we do great things, and the chimp stacks boxes and reaches a banana. And so you say, well, what a difference that 1% makes. Well, maybe that 1% difference is not all that large, even intellectually. We tell ourselves that, but maybe it isn't. Let's just continue this experiment. Find any other life form that has 1% genetic difference in the same direction of intelligence as we are from chimps. What would we look like to them? 1%. 1%. Well, the smartest of us, they would roll Stephen Hawking forward and say, this one is slightly smarter than the rest because he can do astrophysics calculations in his head. Like little Timmy over here who just came home from preschool. This is the alien Timmy with 1% more DNA than we have in the intelligence spectrum. So, Timmy, what did you do today? Oh, I derived the fundamental laws of calculus. Oh, let's put that on the refrigerator with a magnet. Yes, because the smartest chimps do what our toddlers can do. So why should we think that the smartest humans wouldn't do simply what the toddlers can do of this other hypothetical species that I just told you about? Mm-hmm. So they would not possibly think of us as intelligent. And their simplest thoughts, they would be incapable of communicating to us in the same way you cannot tell a chimp, oh, yeah, at 3 o'clock, I'm taking an airplane to Tokyo, and we have a business meeting tomorrow morning, and could you order the lunch? That is an impossible construct for a chimp to understand, yet is one of the simplest things you might say to another human being. So, yeah, we should not think of ourselves as the measure of intelligence in the galaxy.
About 30 seconds to the next break. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Is that when the music comes in, like in the Oscars?
Yeah, but before we get that, before we get okay. there, one more mind-blowing fact, please.
Oh, quick. Okay. Yeah. So the same works with air. So there are as many air molecules in a breath of air as there are breaths of air in all the Earth's atmosphere. So when you exhale, there's enough molecules to scatter into every other possible breath that anyone takes. So again, when you take a breath, there are molecules of air in your lungs that had been inhaled by Sigmund Freud, by Beethoven, by Billy the Kid. So we are connected in ways that you, when you'd like to think you are separate and distinct, no, this goes deep.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Everyman astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is my guest this hour. His new book out today is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. You can join the conversation here. Are you still upset with his verdict on the once planet Pluto? Does the vastness of the universe overwhelm you? Does it excite you or comfort you? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. In September, at the International Astronautical Congress in Mexico, Elon Musk described why he wants to send humans to Mars.
One path is we stay on Earth forever, and then there will be some eventual extinction event. I don't have an immediate doomsday prophecy, but it's eventually history suggests there will be some doomsday event. The alternative is to become a space-faring civilization and a multi-planet species, which I hope you would agree that is the right way to go. Yes?
Dr. Tyson, talk about this a little bit. We had a SpaceX rocket go up just this week. I mean, Elon Musk says he wants to send the first human mission to Mars as soon as 2025. Do you think that's possible?
And so there are three things there. There's one, let's colonize Mars. The other one is he's launching rockets. And the third one is he wants to...
he's got a lot on his agenda, yes.
Okay, there's a lot and he's still making a Tesla car. So let's back up.
Is that a no?
No.
On all three points? I hear a little skepticism there. Okay.
So it makes good headlines to say let's become a... And it kind of makes sense at first cut. When you say, let's become a multi-planet species so that our species does not go extinct if there's some catastrophic event on one planet relative to another. So that, you know, you can make a rational argument for that. However, there's a practical side of this that has been neglected. And I'm a practical guy, I think. So here it is. You ready?
Yeah.
We kind of know the kind of things that can render you extinct, like an asteroid could come, you know, from space. And it took out the dinosaurs, and we don't want that same fate. There could be some killer virus that runs rampant. There could be, you know, any of these things could happen. I agree. However, you have to ask the question. To colonize Mars means you're living there. And presumably, it doesn't mean you're living in a bubble on Mars, because then you're living like on Earth on Mars, right? You're living on Mars. To do that, you'd have to terraform Mars. And that would be the coolest thing ever if we could do that. No doubt about it. But what it's saying is we should terraform Mars and then ship a billion people there or some number of people that can then start a new branch of humanity. And somehow that's easier than deflecting the asteroid. So almost any doomsday scenario you can come up with, it will be easier to preemptively avoid that fate than to terraform Mars and ship a billion people there. If you have the power to ship a billion people there, you have the power to bat asteroids wherever they're coming from in the galaxy and in the solar system, bat them out of the way. If you worry that we'll destroy Earth and Earth will then kill us, if you had the power to terraform Mars into Earth, you have the power to turn Earth back into Earth.
Hmm.
So in practice, it's not a solution to that problem. That doesn't mean I don't love me some Mars. Totally. Let's go to Mars. No problem about it. But to say we need to go to protect the species. And by the way, if you do split into two planets and an asteroid does come to one planet and somehow we can't figure out how to deflect it, you're really going to sit there and say, goodbye, 12 billion people on the other Earth. you will die and we will all survive. Isn't that a good thing? No, you want to save everybody. So I don't see it as a real scenario, a practical scenario, compared to what we would actually think of doing under those circumstances.
Let's get Paul in here from Littleton, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. Glad you waited. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You bet.
So one of the most exciting things that I've observed in my adult life is this discovery of exoplanets. My daughter and I have shared this joy. It's just been wonderful to see. But one of the things that has perplexed me is, you know, these planets are so far away. And although we've been able to pick up, you know, that these planets exist, how are we ever going to figure out whether those planets have life occurring on them. I know that there's always going to be like there's the possibility because they exist in a certain habitable zone, but how are we going to discern the information that's being given off by that planet from our distant observations that life is occurring on those planets?
Paul, thank you. Neil deGrasse.
Yeah, excellent, well thought out question. I wonder how Paul is, if he's still on. I wonder how old his daughter is. If anyone born after 1995, because 1995 was the first announcement of the first exoplanet, I want to call that generation Generation Exoplanet, because they've only known life in the company of news that we know of star systems beyond our own. And so there is an emergent industry, an emergent subfield of the search for planets that has not yet made headlines because they're still working on the hardware to enable it. And these are cases where a planet eclipses the host star from our line of sight. And if it passes in front of the host star, it means light from the host star, if that planet has an atmosphere, will pass through the atmosphere. And we know very well what happens when light passes through a gas. The gas leaves a spectral fingerprint. The gas leaves a spectral fingerprint on the light that is passing through. And you use a spectroscope on our side of that equation and look at that light from the star and you find out, whoa, it's got signatures of oxygen and methane and other chemicals that we have evidence could only be there in the presence of the actions of life on their surface. Now, that would be more true for oxygen than for methane. We know of ways to make methane that does not require life, but life also gives you methane. So if you're making a list, you can put the ones that are most likely to indicate a surface presence of life. And we call these biomarkers. That is sort of the next 10 years of headlines that you'll be noticing. And we're all very excited about those prospects.
Paul, thank you very much. And my son will be delighted to be called the exoplanet generation, I'll tell
Generation
you.
Exoplanet.
That's excellent. Right. Simple question from Facebook. Jay asks, why did you kill Pluto?
Pluto had it coming. Plus, I didn't kill Pluto. I was an accessory for sure.
Okay, but for those who don't know, you lobbied to have Pluto stripped of its status, right, as the ninth planet.
No, I don't lobby. I don't tell anybody anything. All we did when we rebuilt the New York's Hayden Planetarium and opened to the public in the year 2000, we wanted to future-proof the exhibits, and we saw that there were some icy bodies that had just been discovered in the outer solar system that kind of looked like Pluto. And in fact, they and Pluto looked more like one another than either of them look like the rest of the planets in the solar system. So all we did was take Pluto and group it with a whole discussion of these icy bodies in the outer solar system. That's all we did. But the New York Times caught a hold of it, and they had a page one story below the fold, but a page one story saying, "The Pluto not a planet? Only in New York." And then I got hate mail from third graders.
I was going to say from kids, right?
Oh, yeah. My God. I was public enemy. And all we did was tell the truth about what's going on out there. We didn't demote Pluto. We just grouped it with its brethren. And I think it's happier there. It's one of the biggest of the icy ice balls rather than the puniest of the planets. And the Pluto lovers out there, hardly any of them know that our moon is five times the mass of Pluto. Our moon. And if Pluto were where Earth is right now, heat from the sun would evaporate its ice because it's more than half ice by volume. Heat would evaporate that ice. The technical word is sublime. It would evaporate that ice and it would grow a tail. My, that's no kind of behavior for a planet. Plus, Pluto crosses the orbit of another planet like comets do. So Pluto's a perfectly fine member of the solar system. But once you look at the details, it's hard to just put it in with the club of the rest of the planets. Now, you could take this one step further. Jupiter has storms bigger than all of planet Earth on it. Okay? So if you came upon the solar system, an alien, you would say, oh, it's got four planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and everything else is just debris. Because Jupiter is more bigger compared to Earth than Earth is compared to Pluto. So if you're just going to invoke size on this, Jupiter has more argument to get rid of Earth than Earth has to get rid of Pluto if it's only based on size. But we have other criteria as well. So it's gone. Well, it's still there. It's just called a dwarf planet, and just get over it. That's all I'm saying.
Here's Brian in Bridgeton, Maine. Hi, Brian. All you're right. On the air.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Jane. Hi, Dr. Tyson.
Hello.
I just had a quick question. Do you think we'll see extensive space tourism in the next, 10, 15, 20 years and maybe
yes.
beyond low Earth orbit?
Yes, it'll drive the entire economy. Yeah, I'm sorry, it would drive the entire economy of our future in space tourism. I have no doubt about it. Until we learn how to mine asteroids, then the mineral resources and mining, the first trillionaire will be the first person who figures out how to exploit the natural resources of asteroids. So, yes.
It will drive our economy? Does that mean the average person?
No, drive the space economy. It will turn what is now a space program into a thriving space industry, for sure.
Brian, thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Here's James in Buffalo, New York. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hi, James. Hi. Dr. Tyson. This is an absolute pleasure to actually be able to speak with you. The question I actually had was how would you how would you confront individuals or how would you communicate with individuals who basically deny most factual scientific information? Because in today's modern age, most people basically just pretend as though scientific fact doesn't exist as long as if it doesn't agree with the worldview that they have.
James, thanks.
Yeah,
Neil?
Yeah, thanks. So first, I'm reminded anytime I hear someone that speaks with complete ignorance, and ignorance, by the way, ignorance just means not knowing. But if you're ignorant and you think you know, so it's the crime of not knowing but think you know and then acting on that. That's just the recipe for disaster. So, but I'm reminded that we live in a free country. You ought to be able to think what you want and say what you want. And I have no problems with that as a fundamental reality. The problem arises if you do not understand how and why science works and you rise to power and you create legislation that's anchored in your ignorance. This is, as we said earlier in the broadcast, that's where you begin to unravel the foundations of an informed democracy. So I'll give you an example. I walk into buildings and there's some buildings. I live in New York City, a lot of tall buildings. Some buildings don't have a 13th floor. Most of them don't. Two-thirds of them, and some streets, 80% of the buildings don't have a 13th floor. And I'm saying, this is the United States of America, and we have people walking among us afraid of the number 13, superstitious about it. And I thought to myself, that's fine. We live in a free country. Fine. But they should not be tasked with designing elevator banks. There are plenty of jobs for you if you have trixodecaphobia. But stay out of the world where the rest of us want to go to a 13th floor. What do I say to them? I say, your speech is protected. But just because your speech is protected doesn't mean the Constitution guarantees that what you say is accurate. And if you don't want to die poor, you better figure out how to know what science is, because that is going to be the recipe to keep you alive and stoke our economy and at the end of the day provide the security we will need entering the 21st century.
James, thanks so much for the call. It's been a while since we've had a mind-blowing fact, so why don't you throw one in for the book?
Okay, let me give you one. So you ready?
Yep.
So a dark energy, something discovered in the last couple of decades, is a measurement that the universe is accelerating in its expansion. If that we don't know what's causing it, but we can measure it. All right, so it's a big mystery, but it's there. If this continues, which we think it will, then in trillions of years, our nearest galaxies will have accelerated away from us and gone beyond our horizon of detection. The day that happens, if there's a new emergent species who's trying to figure out the history of the universe, there'll be no galaxies in their night sky to reveal it to them. They will try to understand the world, missing an entire chapter of the history of the universe, unless we keep very good records and pass it down through time and keep them in a kind of Library of Alexandria for the galaxy. And fine, that leaves me wondering. What keeps me up most at night is whether our investigations of this universe are somehow missing a chapter that have been ripped from the book of knowledge that we are trying to decode, some chapter that we don't even know was there, leaving us helpless in our attempts to understand what is unfolding in front of us. I lose sleep over that.
So we've got about a minute left.
A bit. Wow. Okay.
I wish we had another hour, actually, but we don't. You share some mind-bending tweets.
Well, we're in a hurry, and that's what the book is. Astrophysics for people in a hurry. You only have an hour? Let's do it in an hour.
All right. We did it.
Oh, by the way,
I
also did the audiobook.
Yeah.
So if you're in a hurry because you're in traffic and you're in a hurry and you don't have time, you can listen to it.
You're a good pitch man, too. I like that. That's right. You've got mind-blowing tweets on everything. You've also been suggesting names for Beyonce's twins. Cosmic
you
names.
You went there. You went there, huh?
I had to. I saved it for the end. What are your suggestions for the queen bee, Dr. Tyson?
Yeah, I just had some well, I only did this because I think her daughter was named Blue Sky or something, or there's some innovative name
Blue
for her
Ivy.
Other kid.
Yeah.
Blue Ivy, thank you. Yeah. So I thought, okay, well, she's open for some suggestions. So I just found a lot of paired phrases and words in the universe just to put it out there. And many of them actually are gender neutral. So you can no matter who they are or what gender they assign or choose, many of them will work. But I think my favorite was the last one I posted, which was what was it? Quinn and Tessence.
All
Quintessence.
Right. Last 10 seconds. Give us our last blind, mind-blowing fact for the hour.
Oh, in 10 seconds?
Yeah, in 10 seconds. You can do it. Go.
Oh, yeah. The universe will expand and end not with a bang, but with a whimper, and not in fire, but in ice.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you so much. So great to have you here today.
Oh, it's a delight. Anytime to talk about the universe.
His new book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.